Okay, what's the policy on drinking during the stream?
That's fine.
Okay. All right, this is your podcast. You have to kick us off and introduce us.
I do. I normally would start with the sync clap, but we don't have to do that this time.
What's a sync clap?
So when you have two different audio tracks, you get people to, at the start of it, clap so that there is a big spike in the visual of it.
So that's so that you can orient the two tracks if they start at the same time. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I get that. But we're on the same thing. Yes.
Yeah.
I was talking about like a podcast style introduction.
Oh, yeah. Hello and welcome back to... it's not going to be Movie Review Corner. It's going to be, These Boys Have Opinions.
Yeah, we have opinions, and we watched a movie, The Old Guard, and, yeah, we have opinions on it. We have interpretations of it.
I need to introduce you first.
Okay.
Hi, welcome back to my co-host.
Hello, hi, I'm Mr. Co-host. My name is Parth.
Why do you think you can talk about movies?
Because we watched a movie, and normally we talk a lot about movies during the movies to the point where we pause every 5 minutes on average, I want to say. Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm being, like, conservative about it. And we talk during those pauses, and then we finish watching the movie, and then we still talk some more afterwards. So I think that by pure experience alone, I'm qualified to continue talking about movies. Just now, this time, I am being recorded for it.
That's fair. I would like to say I have those same qualifications, but I don't. I have not started doing this intense of talking during a movie until I started watching them with you.
Okay, so you're saying...
Not to mean that I haven't tried.
Okay, so you're saying that... I am, in fact, responsible for this idea, and that I am responsible for you thinking this hard about movies.
This is your intellectual property? No, actually. I just was stymied at an early age from talking during movies and doing play-by-play reviews. Which, as you could tell, watching this movie, it was incredibly difficult to not fucking say anything.
Yeah, you struggled a bit.
Just making wild gestures.
You made wild gestures, you made a few reactions, and then you couldn't contain your absolute admiration at certain scenes. Now, granted, you also had the foresight of knowing that they were coming because you've seen this movie before.
I saw this movie, like, about when it came out. So that's 2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago, for reference, The Old Guard, a Netflix original, maybe, I think.
No.
No?
There was no Netflix on there.
There was a Netflix intro at the beginning. There absolutely was.
Are you sure?
100%. And now that I looked the movie up...
Listen, we don't fact-check on this shit.
The Old Guard 2, everything we know about the Netflix sequel...
Oh, I don't... Okay.
So 4 years ago. Four days ago. That. Okay.
I literally... We're not even going to talk about it. We're not going to think about it.
We're not going to think about it until the very end. Until we've discussed literally everything else. Yeah. Then maybe.
So we watched The Old Guard with... I don't know how to say her name. Charlize Theron.
I didn't even read the actress's name.
It's that.
I should do that right now. Hold on.
Apparently did a lot of training. It's at the top. It was there.
Charlize Theron.
I think I want it to be like Charlie Theron.
That's disrespectful.
Anyway. Yeah. Oh yeah. Probably. I think she's like South African or something.
That sounds about right.
Which like
cool. Good for her. I don't know much about the actors, and quite frankly, I don't care. I'm happy to just let it be that they played their parts well.
So within the scope of the movie, The Old Guard, initial thoughts?
General feeling. Mm-hmm. They were absolutely trying to capture a mood with the movie. They were trying to capture a theme and try to tell a story using what are effectively superhumans, but not in the superhero sort of way, but just superhumans. And they were trying to really just drive home that feeling. And you know what? I think they did really well, mostly on purpose, somewhat on accident. And then they kind of not dropped the ball, but it's slipping in their hands a little bit. But I don't think that's necessarily their fault or something that they did wrong. Maybe I'm just reading too much into the movie. Maybe I saw something that they didn't intend.
Oh, no, you can please read into the movie all that you
okay.
want.
Okay, I think... that they missed the point of their own movie, quite frankly. But not in a bad way.
I love that.
But not in a bad way.
As a thesis.
And not by much. They were very, very close. Now, that's the pessimistic way of looking into it. The optimist way of looking into it is, in fact, that one of the main characters is, in fact, a flawed person and blind, and it kind of fits with the rest of her characterization. The movie. Yeah. Yes, so if that was intended, then congratulations, they played 5D chess and they nailed their own theme even better than I could hope.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I only have the text of it to go off of, but you know what? In general, I have a deep personal appreciation for reasons, for the theming, for the story that they are trying to tell, and I am glad that they tried to do it. I enjoyed watching it. It was a good movie. So overall, would recommend.
But we're not here to recommend movies. We're not here to tear them apart.
We're here to look into them as deeply as they can be looked into.
Through the lens of, I don't know.
And if anyone who is listening to this and getting spoilers out of it.
Oh, yeah, there's...
There's going to be spoilers.
Huge spoilers. I don't know why you're listening to this if you... I mean, if you haven't seen the movie and don't plan on seeing it, okay, whatever.
Then you can pause right now and go watch it and then start because
No. Listen to us talk about it and tear it apart and then go watch
True. If we tear it apart and you feel like you want to put it back together and watch it yourself, go for it. That's a perfectly valid post-spoiler experience.
Yeah, I'm actually going to have a lot of praise for this movie because, like... I enjoyed it the first time that I watched it because of a lot of Tumblr-based imagery that I was subject to around the time that made me want to go and get it.
Of course it was Tumblr.
We have a story here that has a number of different themes and a number of different things to tell, things to say, both like at surface level, extremely in your face, this is what it is, and then slightly more subtextual with its parallel
story. Yes, and in the surface level, like I said, it's a superhero movie or superhuman movie, whatever you want to call it.
The thing is, unfortunately, I don't think it's a superhero movie. I think it is, as it says in the descriptor right there, action. I think it's a shoot 'em up movie, which is really unfortunate, honestly, because like there's those Rambo type shit where you just want to see somebody go through, mow down a bunch of, quote, bad guys, and then blow up a bunch of stuff. Like, that is what this movie is framed as.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of the advertising for it specifically was just like, hey, look at this leading lady. She's beating up people. And that was...
I'll take your word for it, because I've never seen this trailer. I've never seen a trailer for it. Never heard of it before you mentioned wanting to watch it together and do this. So I'll take your word for it, and I will believe you.
I don't see why you wouldn't.
I would also just sort of contend that even if they do frame it as that, with the basic premise of, all right, here's a last chance. No spoilers incoming. A covert team of immortal mercenaries. They are functionally immortal for all intents and purposes within their own control.
Yeah.
And that means, like it or not, they are superhuman. Superhero? Debatable.
Yeah, superhuman, but like I would posit that most, and I'm going to get to the fact that she is a Marine, the nonsense about like special ops, special forces, fucking Punisher style shit, where it's like, yeah, these people doing all the shoot bang are essentially superhuman in their abilities and skills, because their abilities and skills are not a direct result of their one special thing. They are a result of years, millennia of training, of keeping up with the latest weapon technologies, honing their skills, etc.
Right.
Which is the kind of thing that Americana gun lover shit is really into. And unfortunately, they did pull me in, not with the gun loving shit, but with the weapons.
With the physical weapons. You just really love that axe. And to be fair, the moment
I saw that axe on like a fucking gift set on Tumblr, I was just like, shit, I need to see this movie. Fuck. I love this shit. The sword play. There's so many good sword play moments.
It was very good. It was very good, despite the fact that none of the people who actually specialized in hand-to-hand combat weaponry, aka that axe, none of them were ever up against anyone else who had any significant training in any other form of melee weaponry. And I'm not going to count that one guy with a baton.
No.
That such a wimpy example that I think it was meant to highlight just how many centuries of training these guys had and how they were, in a way, stuck in their ways.
I mean, that could also definitely be one of the more subtle themes of the movie, which is the reject modernity, embrace tradition. Except, like, the whole, like, oh, you've forgotten how to hand-to-hand combat, or you have forgotten how to wield less, quote-unquote, advanced weaponry, and you suffer for it. Like, a lot of people died because they were not able to deal with the lack of gun.
I understand exactly what you're getting at there. And I'm not even going to say that you're wrong, because, quite frankly, that's probably what they were meaning to capture.
Oh, gee, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You're not going to say that I'm wrong. Okay.
I'm not going to say that you're wrong.
Thank you.
I'm also just going to posit that that's not the main point that I got out of here.
Trust me, there's way more to it than that. I just think that is one of the things, because, of course, the new person that they bring into the fold.
The new girl.
As the, like, this is the modern person. This is the new blood being brought into this old and very, like,
the old guard, as it were.
Story. Wow, do you think they did that?
No. but as I'm probably going to get into, the title, The Old Guard, is very, very load-bearing in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean that in a good way, but it is kind of really setting the tone for basically how I at least interpreted all of the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they put it front and center within the first, like, 30 seconds. I think they have the cold open of, we're looking at dead lady's face on the ground with a voiceover. That is, essentially boils down to record scratch. Oh, boy. How did I end up here?
How did I end up? Yeah. Our cold open was with our main character, Andy, also known as Andromache of Scythia.
Scythia?
Okay, yes. She's very, very dead. She has bullet holes in her face.
Multiple, in fact.
Yes, she's very dead.
Her eyes are completely dilated, despite there being a flashlight being shown directly in her face. Yeah, all of the hallmarks of being dead are certainly there.
Yes, and yet we are also immediately thrust into the reality of, wait a second, no, she's not. Because what does her voiceover say? Maybe every time
here
I think,
I am again.
maybe this'll be it. Maybe it'll happen this time. And it doesn't take much of imagination for me, at least, who's seen way too much sci-fi, to realize, okay, she's not actually dead. Mm-hmm. What is the nature of her being undead? Is she going to resurrect in a different body? Is she going to resurrect as herself in a different place? Who knows? But she's not dead, one way or the other.
Is she a slug that we can take out of the brain case of the current body and put into the brain case of another body? It's just unclear.
Yeah, the details are fuzzy, but we know immediately that she is not dead. Now,
which is fun.
And that leaves...
Which I hope is a really big draw, because you didn't get any spoilers going into this movie.
Yes, that's true. I completely avoided any and all information about this.
Which, congratulations.
Thank you. But what I really want to praise that initial scene for, and again, I don't know if they did this on purpose or not, but I want to think that they did. They made it really clear to any discerning viewer that, okay, she's not dead. Probably her friends aren't either. But the immediate question is, okay, not how isn't she dead? Because no one cares. We'll figure that out later. Why isn't she dead? Mm-hmm. And that singular question is, this is my thesis, this is the expanded spoiler version of my thesis.
All right.
The entire rest of the movie was designed to answer that single question that was posed in the very first scene. Mm-hmm. Why isn't Andy dead? No one gives a fuck about any of their characters. We don't care. We know from the moment we see them that they are not in any danger.
Listen, the other characters do have important things that the narrative is trying to say.
Yes, they have very important roles, but that's not
That's not the crux
but
of it.
But you can boil them down to B plots if you really want. Very important B plots, but still B plots. Mm-hmm. The A plot is the singular question, why isn't Andromache of Scythia dead?
Mm-hmm. Which, very good. They ended up answering that question a couple of different times.
They answered it a couple of different times in a couple of different ways. Mm-hmm. And my half dissatisfaction is that I'm not sure they got the right answer still. I got a
completely out of all of them?
Out of all of the ones they mentioned, I don't think mm-hmm. they mentioned the correct one.
So the big one, just skipping forward, the big one at the end was just that, oh, you are not dead because the good works that you are doing are eventually, down the line, having more positive consequences. You save XYZ person, their descendant is going to do something amazing for a wider scope of humanity, basically. Like, somehow you are the domino.
Right, and a big portion of the movie can revolves around how Andy sort of lost faith in humanity.
Yeah.
And she doesn't feel like that they're truly making a difference to the point where she thinks that it'd legitimately be better for them to hide out and do nothing. God.
The beginning of the movie opens with Booker basically coming to her and being like, hey, we've got a job. This is why I brought you here. And her just extremely ham-fistedly being like, I don't see the point in this. The world is being fucking terrible. Mm-hmm. Nothing that we do matters. Like, almost verbatim.
Yeah.
That was her argument, which, yeah. like,
and she had and she had just enough of a spark of hope to do it anyway.
To want to save some kids.
To want to save some kidnapped teens, preteens.
Yeah,
and try to do something good. Try to bring a little light in this dark, yeah. dark world that she sees around her.
Fundamentally, she is a person who believes in hope and positivity, or at least for the majority of it, she has believed in that.
She has nothing else to hold on to because she is so alone in the world now yeah. that the grim, grim hope that there is something out there worth fighting for is literally the only thing keeping her sane. Because otherwise she is, in fact, also drowning. Like, a yeah. certain, definitely not ex-girlfriend.
Oh, yeah, definitely not. That was a completely straight,
yeah.
straight, yeah. For together reference, till the end.
Yes. For reference, this ex-girlfriend, who's, okay, definitely not Quinn. Ex-girlfriend, Quinn,
yeah.
she was thrown into an iron cage and just drowned in the middle of the ocean. And she, as far as Andy knows,
continued to do so until
just no, I think that
I think
she knows that Quinn is still out there and still drowning, but she's yeah. given up all hope of actually being able to find her. And in fairness, depending on where they dropped her off, mm-hmm. it would literally be impossible to retrieve her with today's yeah. technology anyway.
However, I do want to point out something. Because I love to assume that something is not done for the convention of filmmaking. If I can decide to be like, no, that's canon. We were able to, through the magic of videos, see her at the bottom, quote unquote, bottom of the ocean, which means light was penetrating that far down, which means that she
was not
can only be in a certain. It's a huge percentage still, but she is somewhere where it is shallow enough that the water can penetrate down. Now, I don't know how fucking far down that is because I did not bother to look that up and we're not going to.
We're not going to.
But that's like, what, 50, 100 feet, 150 feet, 200 feet. It's like within the range of like...
Not Mariana Trench.
The Mariana.
Yeah, that one. Yes, that one.
I love that. Yeah, she's not in the Marinara Trench.
Not the Pesto Trench. Okay. Oh, God.
No, the Pesto Trench, we don't even talk about that. Yeah. That shit's scary.
Yeah, that's...
It's got all kinds of things in it.
Yeah, it's weird out. Right. It's weird down there. Right. Anyway, but okay, you know what? I accept that theory that yeah. maybe she wasn't...
She's actually pretty gettable, I think. Also, I know that you are probably not going to... I fucking forgot how they did it, but in JoJo's Bizarre Adventure,
of course.
They did have a character who was locked in a coffin and tossed off the side of a ship, and then later was found and brought back up, and was similarly an immortal
person. I want to point out that Bootstrap Bill Turner from Pirates of the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
he was one of the pirates who famously, in Curse of the Black Pearl, took some of the cursed gold and basically became a spooky skeleton under the moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
And as of the second movie, Pirates of the Caribbean, we learned that because he was never able to return his gold himself, he was always still cursed. Oh. And if you remember, he was tied to a cannon and left to drown at the bottom of the ocean. Oh. So he was permanently in a state of drowning, but he didn't get to die in any sort of finality and come back. Yeah. He was just in a permanent state of drowning, and that is ultimately why he took up Davy Jones's offer. Anyway, I just wanted to, I want to bring up that parallel as sort of the eternal drowning is a very a thing. It's a thing in literature.
I do also want to bring up that, like, after, like, if you have the wherewithal, and I'm not saying that I would have the wherewithal in that situation, I've never been drowned before, so I can't say. If you have the wherewithal to know that this is going to keep happening, you're continuously going to wake up, have a couple of moments of maybe not lucidity, but control, motion, doing stuff, you could probably work at one spot on a thing.
I am going to challenge that notion for this particular movie, but I also know where you're coming from because they did a pretty bad job of showing it in this movie. But I don't think that these people's resurrection really gives them the power to... I don't think it gives them any special privileges, so to speak, when it comes to the nature of how they wake up. Like, for example, when they are shot and they start healing their wounds and they start waking up, their full biology needs to be fully repaired and back to normal before they are actually, in fact, conscious. Now, again, they don't do a very good job showing this, but it's really important because I think for Quinn, one very critical aspect of her drowning, and that we don't see a very good representation of, or very obvious representation of, she's only barely conscious during this process. Her immortality brings her back to the point where she is now alive again, and her brain can now continue dying due to oxygen starvation. But she's never truly awake in this, our sense of the word.
I wouldn't say oxygen starvation, however, because in that lovely, lovely scene where we're just like pulling out from looking at her face as she is just on the bottom of the ocean, there's bubbles.
Yeah, that part makes no sense.
Yeah, that I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, that I'm not quite sure about, but you know what? I'm also going to allow for the leeway that their immortality allows for total baryogenesis. So they basically, TLDR, they can make new blood. Yeah. And that new blood, it doesn't have any anemic properties or anything like that. It's fully oxygenated. Yeah, no. They're perfectly healthy.
At some point they keep losing a bunch of like bits of themselves. There's like everything has to be able to be recreated extremely quickly out of what is essentially nothing.
Exactly.
And that's the fantastical
aspect. Yeah, we don't see any mutilated limbs or cut fingers or anything like that, so we don't know for sure. But I would hazard to guess that they would grow back out of nothing. And my theory for the bubbles, therefore, is that because her blood kept coming back and her blood was fully oxygenated, she is therefore conscious just long enough for enough blood to keep her alive for a few split seconds at most, and for carbon dioxide to be pumped out from her lungs. And that is the source of the bubbles.
Yeah, right. At any rate, the only thing I'm trying to say is that, hey, you know what? If you, after a certain amount of time, if your brain was just not broken already, which, to be fair, she was introduced to us as an already, like, completely broken, giving up person. Like, she was just kind of lying in the desert when Andromache found her. Like, so she, I guess, was already...
not far off.
Had already given up at one point in her never-ending life. So,
yeah, before she was finally not alone.
I'm just saying, I would have tried to work at a specific spot until I could prize open some part of it, but, you know, that's just me being like, it sucks to be you, sorry I'm built different, etc., etc.
Yeah, I think that's you being an asshole.
Yeah.
And I also think that there's a legitimate possibility that one of the things that seems to be completely unaffected, either positively or negatively, by their resurrection, is their memories.
Yes.
No matter what exactly kills them, including straight up a bullet to the brain, every single person who has received bullet to the brain or similarly destructive death.
You know, they are back at it.
They are back at it, but most importantly, they are able to remember that they were shot. Yeah. There is not the physical ability to form even short-term memories in that time between when the bullet has hit your brain and when it has destroyed your brain.
Okay.
Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. Have we tested that? Have we tested somebody's short-term
memory? I don't think so. But I would be willing to bet that bullets travel faster than any neurotransmitter or a neural signal. I would be willing. Like those work in the 300 to 400 miles per hour range.
I think
bullets are supersonic.
True. All right. I will give you that. I think because they wake up before they're fully healed. They wake up when they're mostly healed. Like with there's still wounds that are being closed up all over their faces when they have been shot. I think that because that happens, they also have the pain receptors there.
And so they can put the pieces together. Yeah. And we also see we hear little clips of like bullets being like popped out of injuries and whatnot. So I think, so I think part of it is them just like putting the pieces together afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Making the most reasonable guess for a
exactly
situation.
But to that end, my conclusion there though is that just because they're immortal doesn't mean their memories are perfect. Mm-hmm. There is opportunity, admittedly not much because they're pretty freaking hardy. There is an opportunity for their memories to be scrambled, and I think that's also what's happening to Quinn. Just because she is ostensibly alive for brief spasms of time as she is drowning, that doesn't mean she's conscious enough to really remember all of it. Conscious enough to fuck her up and for a little spasms of dream to come out. Obviously. Yeah, we see that. But not necessarily enough for it to be a fully conscious thought, and I think very, very importantly here, that is also why the others are not having constant nightmares of her. Yeah. It is the only explanation because they didn't have visions of Niall before Niall died for the first time. Whether that's because she actually wasn't activated before, or whether because it is the actual pain of death that is the call signal for everyone.
So I think we haven't actually said yet. So this group of immortals is immortal specifically because when they die and when they get hurt, they heal insanely fast, essentially. Yeah. Like, and it leaves
no trace whatsoever. If you need to scale for speed, it's Wolverine fast.
It's Wolverine, like bullets will be shoved out of holes, cuts will knit over themselves extremely quickly, like in a matter of seconds if it's surface level.
And their effective pain tolerance isn't lower because of it. It is, in fact, exactly the same as most anyone else's, but they're sort of able to steel themselves through training and just through plain old grit.
Having done it so many fucking times.
Yes, it's like because they know they're going to heal, they can it out for like the split seconds required for the injury to just start healing itself.
They still scream, they still hiss in pain, they still move as if actually fucking injured, which like honestly, I do appreciate that level of like commitment to that these are people that still feel. There is not a level of physical numbness that you can get to just because you continuously die.
Yeah. But equally as impressively, they're not calling out in pain. Like part of the human desire to scream in pain.
Niall does.
Yeah, at first.
Yeah.
She gets over Niall's that real quick.
Ah, ow.
Yeah. But like a lot of the human pain response to scream is to basically call out for aid. It's a social instinct.
It's a social instinct, and it also yelling when you're in pain, making loud noises, saying curse words as well, also legitimately releases like painkillers, like actual painkillers.
I saw the Mythbusters episode.
I didn't know that was from Mythbusters episode.
Well, they test it. They test it. Like people who were actively cursing.
Mm-hmm. When like getting zapped or something.
They stuck their hands in ice water and they measured how long they could keep it in ice water before they took it out. And they measured it against
self-induced hypothermia.
And they measured it against a control group who were given a bunch of bland words like banana, pillow.
Oh, okay. So they could still say something.
Yes.
It wasn't just not saying anything.
Yes. It was the difference between curse words and just banal words
just words and
saying
not
nothing. Yes, oh, okay. Only curse words had okay. that effect.
All right.
Because it, I like that. Because it taps into the instinct for for basically calling out for attention. Because calling out for attention is one of the best
ways to get help.
And curse words, they get people's attention more often than the average word.
I think that the yelling yes for help thing is definitely like an evolutionary advantage, but I think the curse word part is just for you. I think that's just a helpful thing.
There's a longer discussion there, but
yeah. It's just like what that came about from, etc.
Yeah. So basically, it's people are able to kind of drive past their kind of base instincts, not by much and not by a level that seems like incredible or superhuman, but they've seen some shit, they dealt with some shit, they're used to this.
Understandable. And even Andromache, the oldest of them all, what is it, at some points alluded to being almost prehistory in some fashion, which like really interesting if that is the case, because like there's a certain point in time from which she cannot be from earlier because she's white.
It's true.
There is a certain point in time at which we cannot go any further back because of the color that she is.
Quite frankly. Just
and the height. She's pretty tall.
That is true. I just went with the assumption that she...
Please tell me got bleached over the years.
No, not that. No. I think that she was either Greek or something very recently pre-Greek. Like...
Okay.
Macedonian or whatever. Mesopotamia, if you really want to go that far back. But I think that...
She's a Fertile Crescent person.
I think that ultimately she's Greek. And not just from her name, which is obviously a giveaway. She could have adopted the name. I don't think she did. I think she was the source of that name.
Yeah. Andromache, I think, is her original name.
Yes. Andromache, which I will point out means man fighter.
Nice.
And there's an Andromache River in Greece. And it is the name of some fuckhead's ship in season one of Black Sails, the one that they had to steal the 12 inches from.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Did you...
And it had the most badass theme song.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Did you look this up specifically?
No.
Or you just knew this because of Black Sails?
I knew Andromache.
Okay.
And I looked up Andromache a long time ago because Black Sails. But there's one very important sort of thematic reference that Andromache kind of brings up. And this is going to be important, and it's going to be such a silly thing.
Okay.
But Amazonian warriors. The idea of a woman supreme fighter who is just... Yeah, she has the aura of independence, but she's also just a martial artist. She has hand-to-hand combat weapons, and she has the total ability to dominate the battlefield with no extra help required.
Yeah.
And, of course, her main companions are preferably female, but in a war, works with whoever's required and whoever happens to be able to fight on her level. Which, notably, it's never really remarked upon how good Booker and the other two male immortals. It's never really remarked upon that they're particularly great fighters. In fact, they talk about how great Andy is and how great Quinn was.
Yeah.
Just like something about Quinn being a viper pit.
Oh, are you a pit viper?
Pit viper, yeah.
Are you insinuating that in this like either sub or super species of humans that it is like woman dominant?
Yes. 100%.
Okay. Interesting.
I am absolutely...
That's a cool look at that.
Yes, I'm absolutely viewing Andromache as being the epitome Amazonian warrior. Because Amazons also had very, very long lifespans and were very tough and resistant. And of course, were very tall and resistant to disease, all that. Basically, they were a super species, even in Greek mythology. Perhaps based upon Andromache in the lore of this movie. I don't know. I think there's some back and forth to be had on which influenced which.
Okay.
But I will absolutely maintain that this hierarchy, yes, the women are distinctly more powerful than their counterparts.
Interesting. I like that as a concept. That's very text-supported thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think the fantastical element of their connections as well is incredibly interesting. Like, they go into it in the first, like, third of the movie, and then they kind of just don't really talk about it too much after that, is the dream connectedness, the pain connectedness. Like, they all had the exact same dream. I really like that they all had the different things that they were able to suss mm-hmm. out of that particular, like, impression. And I do think it's really interesting that, like, until they get to her, until they are near her, they will continue to have those. Like,
yeah.
That was very, very clear. It's like, this will continue to happen. We will see snippets of their life, maybe when they're dying, if they die again. Or maybe we will just, when we dream, we will also see snippets of their life as well until we meet up with them.
Yeah. It's not really clear. It
seems implied that it would be when they die, which is important.
Yeah, because it is mutual pain and trauma that kind of brings them together.
Oh, because she also had visions mm-hmm. of them, kind of in that moment.
Yeah, she does. I think she saw their most recent deaths.
Something like that. No, because if she saw their most recent deaths, it would have been in that basement.
Yeah.
Did she see in the basement?
I don't remember exactly what she saw.
I think she saw them on the train that they were in.
Interesting.
Because I had a very clear picture of Andy's face was in that. And she was sitting across from the three of them. So, I don't know. Honestly, I like the idea. I really love the idea.
Yeah,
like, you have to endure the other person's existence until you get within a certain physical range of them.
Right.
Like, and that's amazing.
And they were aware of each other. Also, parallel implication of Quinn must have known about Andy even before Andy found her. And yet still was tormented by the idea of being alone. So if anything, the visions were taunting her with the face of a woman that she could never have.
I mean,
and might never find.
Depending on how far back it was and where Andy was at the time. Like, for Quinn, she's in the middle of the fucking desert when she was found. So what landmarks are you going to be able to suss out?
No landmarks. And I think that they would have had to get very good at astronomy really quickly.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only way to reliably find someone at that point, because you got to find their latitude. And dear God, they probably found out how to figure out longitude way before, like, modern astronomers did.
I mean, astronomy has been used since, like, literally ancient times.
Yeah.
For, like, naval navigation. Like, I'm sure you know that.
Calculating latitude was discovered millennia before calculating longitude was possible. We had to use, I forget whether it was the sextant or the astrolabe, one of them, but one of them enabled the ability to calculate longitude. Humanity did not have that ability before.
Damn. I know the sextant is the one that's kind of like a little boat looking thing that kind of swings freely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm actually ashamed.
What does an astrolabe look like?
It's kind of like a circular compassy thing. Latitude is northiness and southiness from the equator, which is really mm-hmm. easy. You can just use the stars for that.
Yeah, it's really easy, but because we rotate around that.
Yeah, but axis. Longitude gotcha. Requires really specific
other knowledge.
Longitude, eastiness and westiness. That is impossible to figure out pre-astrolabe/sextant technology. You were only able to figure out how north and south from the equator you were.
Gotcha.
And
that was what I just described with.
Yes, exactly.
Get you north and south. Jesus Christ. Don't say latitude and longitude. I have not figured out which ones those are yet.
That's why I was saying northiness, southiness, eastiness, westiness.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Anyway, point is, Quinn finding, and she gave up finding Andy because she just assumed that it was going to be impossible. And who knows how many hundreds or thousands of years it took for them to find each other. We don't. Measured in the hundreds of years at least.
Oh, at least. For sure. Because, like, they remarked that it was 200 years since Booker joined them. Which, like, to me, it implied that it was very quick. Because the other guys...
In the 1800s, I think the world is small enough that they could at least have landmarks to find each other.
Well, yeah, no, I'm not saying that it's difficult. I'm saying the amount of time in between a new immortal showing up, it was implied to be very short. with only
200 years.
Yeah, because the other guys were the Crusades.
Yeah.
Right? Which was 1100s?
Something like that. I would have said 1100s too. Yeah.
Great. I love how we literally just watched this movie and
they didn't say the years. They just said the Crusades.
They did say the Crusades.
They did not say the years. They left it vague enough.
However long the Crusades lasted, who the fuck knows?
I think there's a very legitimate chance that one of them was born significantly before the other and actually just went on multiple Crusades until he met another immortal warrior.
Yeah.
And they finally just kept on killing each other long enough that they just fell in love.
They did say it was not super clear. They did say at first, we killed each other. And then it was added on many times. So, like, okay, maybe it wasn't the first time that they murdered each other.
Yeah.
But, like, it's the implication I got from that is they were both the first kill for each other. It was like, that was the first time that they died. That was what I got.
Probably.
That was the implication that I found.
Probably. And I think that's also the best, like...
Andy and Nikki.
Easy.
Nikki?
Yeah. Yeah. Niccolo de Genova.
Joe. Which, like, apparently his actual character's Yusuf. Name is Yusuf.
Yusuf al-Kaisani. And Sebastian Levert turns into Booker. Which, you know, good change.
Anything we can do to get away from French.
Anything we can do to get away from French. Italians on thin ice.
No, Italians are... Oh, God. Don't fucking bring up the Italians.
You're setting it, not me. Anyway.
Listen, what I brought to this relationship was my just eternal despisement of Italians. What you brought to this relationship is the idea that the French don't exist.
Are they even a real country?
Nobody can tell. Nobody has been able to give me a definitive answer.
Napoleon had a fucking immortal on his side. And what happened to France? That's right. You know what happened to France.
It is still there.
It is somehow.
It is somehow still there.
Yeah. Just, okay. We'll anyway.
Blame the immortals.
Exactly.
I got in trouble once when I made a kind of like a cheesy little anti-French sentiment. Not even anti-French, just joking that it doesn't exist. And like one of Aaron's friends is apparently
French.
Like French Canadian.
Oh, that doesn't count.
I dug myself a hole.
You think that counts? You think that counts? Any French Canadians, when they go to France, they are despised.
Oh my God.
They are despised. No one likes them. They will literally not talk to French Canadians in French. They will only speak to them in English.
That's a little fucky.
I have a friend who learned French in California, even worse. She really had to perfect her Parisian accent before anyone would talk to her in French.
Oh, jeez. Wow. Fuck the French people. Jesus. Freaking.
Listen. Haughty. Anyway. Okay. This is not... We're getting off topic.
And, yeah, fuck it.
Very much so.
Whatever. It's important.
Yeah.
This is a movie about societies. About... Sure.
Yeah.
About cultures. The amount of different languages that they were speaking as well was also very interesting and only seemed to exist in like the first third of the movie where they were kind of showing off that they were
because it turned into a shooter later. Yeah. But that was actually getting to another similarity that I saw. Niall, who is a Marine in the U.S. Marines.
Which also, let me say.
Listen, I know you.
This is the fucking bootlickiest goddamn inclusion in this fucking movie. I hate it. I hate it so much.
What? And a French Napoleonic soldier wasn't? An Amazonian warrior isn't?
No. It's not. And you know why it's not? Because in this fucking universe, and in our fucking universe, the Amazonians aren't doing anything.
Yeah, I will happily admit that the comparison, the modernization comparison.
What was it? Oh, you come from warriors. Like, fuck off.
Your salt is understood. But it's also not relevant.
Shut the fuck up.
Okay. Listen.
All right, what's your point?
What is the thing that you wanted to talk about? Niall demonstrated one capability that her fellow soldiers did not. One very important one. She actually spoke some Pashtun.
Some?
Yes. She wasn't wholly reliant on the translator.
This is true.
She could actually understand the people speaking to her. And she did rely on the translator for getting the important message across to make sure probably there's no mistranslation. But she knew basic phrases. She was very polite. And listen, I know this is bootlicky, but at least ostensibly, she was trying to, you know, be kind and a force for good in the area that she was in. I will accept that that is a bootlicky portrayal of the U.S. Marines.
Oh, yeah, it's incredibly yes. so.
But it is an important portrayal because it is the thematic core of what kind of makes her similar to at least Andy.
Yes. Yes, yes, I agree with that. That was, narratively, that was the purpose of showing her interacting with the kids, interacting with the women, and just her entire intro scene was just, this is a person who is trying in her own way, in her own limits of where she is to do good.
Limits, that is also an important point, because there was only so much good that Niall could do. But even in her limits, she was trying to exceed them. She was trying to break them. She was trying to save a terrorist's life.
Trying to, yeah, but she kind of ruins it with, they wanted him alive.
Yes, her reason.
Yes,
because I will point that as...
What they want to do narratively is what you were saying. They want to draw parallels between people who want to do the fighting for good, people who want to save people rather than kill, people who want to potentially use violence, but for a good, a
noble cause, an ultimately good cause. And
I feel like they're wrapping. They couldn't not wrap it up with the fucking Marine bullshit nonsense and being in Afghanistan. They couldn't not do that.
At risk of sounding like a bootlicker, I'm not sure what better modern context you'd have preferred that they use. Fine. Don't even use the U.S. Army at all. Fine.
Yeah.
What would you have preferred to have seen? What is your vision of what a modern warrior looks like? Oh, and this is not me trying to do a gotcha. It's just like, I don't have a good answer for this. I think that it's actually thematically important that they are warriors of a nation. They are not solo fighters. Andromache was an Amazon, or in my interpretation, she is an Amazon fighting for her matriarch. Booker, he was a French soldier fighting for Napoleon. Joe and Nikki, they were soldiers fighting on opposite sides of the Crusades, but they were fighting for a higher cause, for ostensibly at the time a national power that they believed in and that they were willing to die for, and they did die for, and then they didn't. And that same thing happened to Niall. We don't know exactly what happened to Andy with regards to her hypothetical Amazon upbringing.
Her first death.
Yes, we don't know. And maybe that's part of the mystery. But
maybe.
And also part of the thing. Why isn't Andy dead? But
why isn't Andy dead?
And we don't know why the other guy, his name started with a K, the immortal who actually died. We don't know why he died for real. But I would be willing to bet, considering that they were all dressed in full military garb and Andy had a full-on spear, I'd be willing to bet that this was some pivotal moment in some war between nations. And he struck a triumphant last blow, but he took one.
Yeah.
Now, here's another corollary question to why isn't Andy dead. Why did he die? Now, the movie tries to answer this question, these questions, together, sort of.
Kinda, yeah.
With regards to Andy, Andy thinks that Niall only came about and that Andy herself lost her immortality because Andy sort of lost faith in humanity. That, like, she had finally lost that last shred of hope.
She lost that that fighting spirit.
Yeah. She was a warrior who was no longer willing to pick up her weapon.
Which would make sense if everyone's was, like, a slightly different variation on that theme. Like, everyone gets an individual, like, reason for why they continue fighting. Because, like, Booker, very clearly, extremely alcoholic, literally always drunk, did not want to be alive, and was as explicit about that as they could have been without just coming up and him saying, like, I want to die.
Yes.
So, like, clearly he wants to give up. He wants to not be there.
But then why is he here?
Nikki and Joe. Something.
Nikki and Joe. Maybe. They were fighting on opposite sides of the Crusades, but they were still alive after they killed each other, and then they got each other. They have this amazing deep bond, this amazing deep love for each other. But why are they still here?
I would posit that it's because they still want to be with the other. Which that is, I like, think... that seems to be the fucking driving force that compels them to do anything.
They love each other so hard that they literally cannot live without each other. They cannot die without each other.
Yeah, they would have to both go at the same time, basically.
Exactly, and they would have to be satisfied with that end for each other.
Which means, honestly, for all intents and purposes, if that's how it's working, they are immortal.
Yes,
they're... Because holy shit.
They're probably the truest immortals here.
Yeah.
Which, if that good is, for them. If that's it.
Hashtag gays stay winning.
Exactly. Can't bury these guys.
Legitimately cannot.
Yeah. Our two most interesting characters here are Niall and Andy.
Yeah.
Why is Niall here? Well, if we're to believe the text of the movie.
To show Andy what it is to, one, be an immortal, and two, want to fight for something, but to believe in a cause, and to,
yeah, to rally kind of remind others to her, do it. To remind her of what her purpose is.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then why didn't Andy regain her immortality? Or did she actually regain her immortality? She just doesn't know it yet.
I believe that she did not regain her immortality. I don't think so either. That would be a little bit cheatsy if they fucked that up. The number of times that they answered the "why is Andy here?" question in the movie was a little bit silly, I think.
And they answered it differently each time, which I think which is the basis for my thinking, that they did not get the correct answer any of those times.
But these are potential things that people, depending on who you are and what you're getting out of this, can latch onto different ones. Because like the drugstore clerk that helped her patch her up, kind of towards the end, who is just like, that, like, we do not belong alone. Or like, we need each other. That's a very good and very succinct way of saying that, like, yeah, people are not meant to suffer by themselves. People are not meant to be disconnected from the world. People are meant to literally just
misery loves company. They said that phrase in the movie. But no, actually, the drugstore clerk. At the
beginning.
Yeah. The drugstore clerk, I was going to get to her as well. Because I think...
Well, I got to her first, so...
Yeah, I know. But she said something very particular.
Mm-hmm.
Today I patch you up. Tomorrow you pick someone else up.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was supposed to reference to Quinn.
Okay, I can give you that might have been a thing.
Yes.
I literally think that that was supposed to be one of the quote-unquote core messages of the film.
I think it can be both, first of all.
Because like that was the entire thing about what they did. Like that was the whole conspiracy wall, was that, hey, today you do this for one person, the next generation, that person's kid does infinitely more for the cause of humanity.
Yeah, I think that's important too.
Like that clearly was one of the themes that they were trying to
get at. that the generational multiplying effect. Like
how much good passes on.
How much good can one person do over the course of eternity in order to steer the direction positively for humanity?
Or just to affect one person.
And the answer, at least in Andy's case, is a whole lot. But there's also a self-correction factor here.
You think
because
so?
Because when Andy lost her faith,
mm-hmm.
she didn't lose her immortality immediately.
No.
Remember, Niall stabbed her.
Yeah.
And she healed just fine from that.
Yeah, it was not an immediate thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But...
around the time.
But when did Andy lose her immortality? Her first wound that actually stuck around was after Niall was already inducted.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's fine. Immortal.
I think specific timing in that doesn't really...
I think it does.
I don't know.
Because it's all we have to go off of. I'm going to take whatever information we can get. Second of all, the conclusion that it leads us to is actually pretty on point. If Andy's purpose... is to be the force multiplier and to save as many people as she can within her lifetime in order to have the best outcome for humanity.
Which has been preternaturally extended.
Yes. And I'm going to make an assumption that whatever force is causing their immortality, you can call it fate, you can call it intelligent design, whatever. I think there is some intent and purpose behind it, that something knows the people that Andy saves will eventually go on to do things.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that is the only thing that really explains it. Because if she just saves a bunch of randos...
I mean, obviously, this is not... I don't believe that any of this is meant to be like a nihilistic philosophical question of what's even the point? Like, no, this is a very pointed people have reasons for things.
Yeah, moving. Exactly. Whatever force is driving their immortality knows exactly what Andy is capable of and mm-hmm. knows exactly what she will do mm-hmm. with that extra time.
Yeah.
And I think that the precise moment that Andy lost her immortality was when she was no longer able to use that immortality to do more good than if she had lost it.
Okay. Gotcha. When like, and in that moment, there was no further point to
keeping her
have her extended anymore.
Yes. Okay. There's no point to having her extended because her job was done. Mm-hmm. But also as a corollary, she was able to do more good things
because she
yeah. was mortal now.
Forced her to regain a little bit of perspective.
Yes.
And pass on more lessons about things.
Yeah, that's the how. The why is because her job was done. Her watch is ended. She has passed on the torch. She only lost her immortality after she introduced Niall to the others.
Yeah.
Her bringing Niall into the fold, sort of as her replacement, was her final act of service. And what was Niall's first act of service? Reminding Andromache who she was, why she existed, and what good she's done this world.
Yeah.
That was her very first thing. And it spread out across all this gun shooting nonsense. But that was her purpose.
Yeah, you know, the talking in between.
Yeah. And now she is the immortal Amazonian queen.
I see. She is now the leader.
Whether Nikki and Joe accept that at first or not.
I think they will. They've got other things to think about. They're more concerned about.
Yeah, I don't think they're really leadership material, either of them. And Booker... I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but they don't seem like they care that much.
Some people are just along for the ride.
Yes.
Some people don't have the managerial aspect to them.
Managerial?
Do you want me to say womanagerial?
No.
I'm not going to.
No. But my point is very succinctly that Booker, Joe, and Nikki are incapable of leadership. Niall is.
Oh, yeah. Niall definitely is.
Yeah, she saw...
It's very unfortunate that her leadership skills did not kick in when she first got resurrected in the tent with everybody. There was a moment there. She could have drawn back into everybody's side. Like, she didn't have to be fucking weird about it.
No, she felt disconnected. These people around her, they were no longer... She had ascended beyond their abilities.
She had died.
She had died. She had gone to the other side and come back. You don't come back. That's the thing. To some extent or another, Niall was no longer human. Niall no longer fit in, and any attempt that she would have made to do so, as Booker very clearly said, it would not have worked. Her humanity was gone because one fundamental thing that keeps us all human, that really binds us all together, is the knowledge that we will die.
I guess, but also I feel like it's important to point out Booker is the pessimistic cream of the crop.
He is.
In this thing. Like, he is meant to, I think narratively speaking, he is meant to be, hey, this is what the worst assumptions about humanity can lead to. This is what thinking that everything is fucking shit will lead you to. Because, admittedly, narratively speaking, he has every reason to do that. However, as far as his purpose in the narrative, it's to be the wet blanket of everything sucks.
Yes.
Let's just look on the bad side of stuff.
Yes.
Which is why I don't really take most of the stuff he says at face value.
You don't have to. I don't think it matters that much, because Niall's purpose, beyond what the mystical hand of fate can guide them to and will ultimately help them achieve, their purpose and the good things that they do are kind of incidental to their ultimate effects. They're not saving the people who eventually grow up to cure cancer. They save the people whose grandchildren grow up to cure cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They just happen to exist in this world, and fate already knows that the future will be better for
it. I just realized something. Their immortality, their what is not immortality, technically speaking, continuation of life is used primarily to be a continuation for other life.
Yes.
They're... Like, if we just stuff this one person full of extra life, then they will dispel it out in a more organic way.
Exactly.
So we don't have to infect everybody with it. We just infect the nice ones with a little bit of extra juice, and then they will do the rest of the
work. You know, there's a fun physics theory, or biophysics theory.
Is that fun?
It is fun, actually.
Okay.
You know about entropy, like second law, thermodynamics, so the universe...
Vaguely familiar with entropy, yeah.
The universe as a whole generally tends towards disorder, and any momentary, like, kind of climbing up to order will ultimately, in the very long run, fail.
Will just dissipate.
Yes. It's much easier to tear down a building than it is to build it in the first place. Sort of deal.
To a certain extent, I guess,
To the majority of extent. You can prove it mathematically.
Okay, yes.
So the theory goes, and obviously this is ridiculously difficult to prove practically, life exists because in the longer life, as like multicellular organisms, or organisms that we are very low entropy. We have a lot of very complex order. We can do incredibly complex things. We can put things together in ways that the universe, as a natural state of being, could never.
Why? We are anti-entropy.
We are anti-entropy. Beings. We tear entropy apart. We ultimately make more in the long run.
I guess.
And
on a cosmological scale, not really.
The theory goes that on that cosmological scale, the reason that life exists at all is because on that cosmological scale, we are more efficient at creating entropy than if life did not exist at all.
Oh boy.
That we are more efficient at tearing apart existence. Planets or solar systems or existence than if planets were just barren.
That's a very interesting theory. I'm not sure if I like it, because that just means that we are essentially large-scale agents of chaos, and that this whole destroying the planet thing was actually intentional, which I don't like that.
You can go all fatalistic all you want. My point is that...
Is this idea of entropy and how we fit into it not inherently fatalistic?
Well, the universe is going to end. Deal with it, bro.
Yeah.
That you can't stop it. Everything between now and then is fatalism. It.
But you saying specifically that life, humans, as we are existing, is going to ultimately bring about entropy faster does kind of fit in with the whole, like, we're destroying the planet.
Yes, but my
That's
point...
That's what I mean.
Yes. My point, though, is that the immortals here are the exact opposite of that. They are agents of anti-entropy, anti-war, anti... destruction.
Does that not mean that on a certain, that if you look at it a certain way, that most people, being the relatively kind or good people that they are in themselves agents of anti-entropy?
Sure, hypothetically. But they have not been blessed by fate. Or fate has not decided that their extended life is good to that ultimate end. Mm-hmm. And who knows what the fuck fate's thinking about all this. Maybe fate's been taking a little too many.
The Greek fates, they have been hitting the Delphi fog a little bit too hard.
Yeah. Maybe they don't know what's coming. Maybe they're not seeing far enough into the future to realize that what they're doing causing too much chaos to actually be worth it. But let's assume that's not the case. Let's assume that whoever these fates are, they can see more than just 2 or 3 generations ahead, and they actually know what they're doing. And
that's a big assumption.
That is a big assumption, but again, we don't know why these people are immortal. We don't know why Andy is still alive. Ultimately, Andy has to make that decision for herself.
Yeah.
Except... that she doesn't anymore.
Yeah.
Her decision's been made for her. Andy is no longer alive. She is no longer immortal. Her fate is done. Her thread has been snipped.
I think she still is, though.
No, she's alive, but she's not immortal.
No, she... obviously, she's not immortal, but I do not think that is the same thing as being dead. Like, she now choose how to live out the rest of her life, because she didn't find out that she was... you know, capable of dying by dying. She managed to just get grievously wounded and then continue on.
Right.
So, like, now it is back in her hand. She gets to decide what the rest of her life is going to result in.
But her impact is going to be noticeably less.
I don't think so. Because they all left together.
Well, not less. But when she dies, her story is done.
I think that's against the point that the movie is trying to make. Because she still walks away with the other three. She is with them.
Yeah.
Therefore, for the rest of her life, which is like 50, 60 years maybe, I don't know how fucking old she's supposed to be, she is going to have a profound effect, mostly on Niall, if we're being real about it.
Yes.
But also on Joe and Nikki.
Yeah, she's going to teach Niall everything she knows, and Niall's going to be a badass Amazon.
Yeah, like, she's literally, like, the effect is still going to continue, and it is going to be extremely pinpointed on her influence. Because, like, as far as we saw, Joe, Booker, Nikki did not really have too much of an effect on Niall. She kind of got the point of some pessimism from Booker, and then Joe and Nikki
logistics
were just kind of like
logistics.
Yeah, just kind of
I think you pointed out a really good feedback loop, though.
Showed a bunch of love,
because actually I don't think that Andromache's influence on Niall post immortality, I don't think that's to Andromache's credit. I think that's Niall's credit, because what was Niall's first act of service? Her first act of service to fate was to save the other immortals and Andy.
Yeah.
Why did she save Andy? Because Andy was going to be her teacher. Andy's going to be Niall's force multiplier to let her continue to act in fate's will.
This is one of those inappropriately named chicken and egg things, though.
Yeah, like I said, feedback like, loop.
It's not a feedback. There is certain information coming from Andromache, and certain information that is being being taken by Niall. But there is also the effect of Niall wanting to take information from Andromache, and Andromache wanting to give information to Niall. Like, they're
sure
it's all going the same direction. But whether or not it is one person or the other that is having more of a purposeful impact because of that, or is like choosing that is what we're doing. You both want to do the thing.
Yeah.
Like, you both get credit for this.
Yeah, you can give Andy credit for that. That's fine. But notice how, two things.
Mm-hmm.
Notice how diligently Niall was working to keep Andy alive.
Mm-hmm.
Taking multiple bullets for her.
I mean, so was everyone else.
Yeah, so was everyone else. But Niall was doing it front and center.
True.
Niall was working harder than anyone to keep Andy alive.
Especially at the end. Oh, yeah. That line of, next time you can go first?
Yes.
It's a pretty pass the torch, you are now the Amazonian leader moment.
Exactly.
All right.
But notably, at least in the eyes of the Fates,
mm-hmm.
Niall was the immortal, not Andy.
Mm-hmm.
The torch was already passed. Andy just realized why it needed to be passed and what good she had done before for it to all be worth it and for it to be worth teaching Niall. And mm-hmm. Niall, in that process, learned exactly what she was capable of. She realized that she was unbreakable. She was Fate's guiding fist. Guided fist.
Guided fist. Enhanced fist.
Yes. She was special weapons technology.
Oh, God.
Fate decided to call in a SWAT team.
So ultimately, what we are saying is that
I am contending that for any of these immortals, Fate has a plan for them. Fate has a long, long-term plan for them. Maybe for Nikki and Joe, it is just to be the gayest couple that has ever been, and that's fine.
I mean, we need that.
We need that. That's fine.
We need an immortal gay couple, one of whom is just a fucking sappy romantic, and the other of whom is willing to kill, and will do so, and is very angry at anyone who dares to try and get between them being sappy as shit.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that they're not, that they are both, like, fucking heart eyes for each other.
And that's their primary purpose.
However, they're both unique and distinct individuals that have unique approaches to life, which is fucking phenomenal.
It is.
I love that.
And Booker, mm-hmm. coming back, being back in 100 years and interacting with Quinn, I don't think it's beyond reason to say that he still has a purpose in this world. It is, the Fates haven't told us yet because they don't tell us shit.
Ultimately, you could make the same case that it was just like the force of their own wills in each individual like activation, the force of their own wills is what caused them to just like pull down from the ether this immortality. That in itself is just like the one random spark of starting it, And then everything from there on is just whatever the fuck happens, happens. Like, honestly, there's no plan whatsoever.
I'd love to believe that. And if that's how it is, though, I actually think that's not going to work out very well, because Booker kind of breaks that.
He does break it.
Booker,
this is true,
has no reason to have that sort of force of will. Booker has to be dragged back from hell every single time. And Nile, while I think that she was definitely fierce and loyal to the end, I don't think she was fighting death. I think that she had, in some level, accepted her fate and was more shocked by how fate did not take her.
I think that slow shot that we had of her with the other soldier's hand on her neck had the tear rolling down her face, specifically because it was like she was not accepting it. She was angry, she was sad, she was, like, obviously she was not able to emote that much, being that she was, like, drowning in blood.
But, I will, you know. I think it's a fair interpretation. I just don't know how it would fit with Booker. And I honestly think that I think that it kind of breaks down.
Well, like, initially he was not the misanthrope that he is. That happened later.
Are you sure he was French?
Like, that just blew up my entire argument. Like,
quite frankly.
Never mind.
Quite frankly, I don't think that anyone's core personality changed meaningfully when they became immortal. Not the slightest bit. I think Andromache was always a stoic, hard-ass go-getter who was just willing to do what is right no matter what. Even when she was falling in the depths of despair.
Yeah, she still giving up on humanity. Up to do it.
She didn't, she never sat down, truly, even. Mm-hmm. She was just like, ah, fuck this. Oh, I gotta fight again? Fine, fuck this. Again? Sure.
I'm angry about it, but I am also not willing to live with the consequences of knowing that I did nothing.
I do not think that is a new thing. Maybe she forgot why and how she was always like this, but I think she was always like this. Nikki?
Walking while dead, basically.
Yeah. Nikki and Joe
still doing it,
falling in love as they were killing each other. I think that was just became their new purpose.
I think they fell in love after they were, you know, done killing each other for what was probably like a full day and night cycle. I think,
you know, no, you know what, I think they fell in love with each other while
they were fighting.
They were killing each other.
Do you think there was banter?
Yes.
You think there was swordplay banter? Yes.
Sure, maybe it was like a day and night sort of thing.
I bet their armor and like whatever it was, like protective shit that they were wearing, eventually just got fucking demolished.
Yeah. It was just them. Most of their clothes had probably fallen off. They were fighting naked. And they were realizing that in the moment of trying to kill each other and failing, they needed each other. They were not in that moment in sexual or romantic love with each other. No. They needed each other. Because
think about it as well. If this happened in a particular fight, either what happened the first time is they both killed each other, they were lying there on the battlefield, and everyone else had moved on.
No, I think everyone else
or,
had died.
Yeah, that. Or they had mowed through each other armies, just a mass of people, and then got to each other, or got to each other, were killed, came back up, and then continued fighting them and the other people.
I prefer to think that they were just two random soldiers in that fight, and the fight was just raging on, and it was everyone else dying to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I mean. Is collateral them damage. Each going through the other set of army, just killing indiscriminately, and if they get downed, if that is how the story went, they would just come back up. But it could also be that in the process of fighting each other and having their palios still there, still fighting, they could have just assumed, like, oh, he only got lightly injured, he's back up on his feet, cool, let's continue, and then everyone else is dead. So, like, at a certain point, they have to look around each other, either everyone else is dead or everyone else has fled, and are looking and seeing, like, oh, okay, it is literally just us.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the time of the Crusade.
And very notably here,
field of dead bodies.
They still need to sleep. Yeah. These immortals do need to sleep. Oh, and at some point, there is going to be a natural endpoint to when they could fight.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just need to take a nap.
Yeah. I think it was one of those, like, hey, let's call a truce for a moment things, because now we are, all of our armor is destroyed, so we're looking at each other face to face. All probably most of the swords, spears, whatever the fuck was around us has been broken by now, because we've used it so many times in the attempt to murder each other.
We're down to hand-to-hand combat.
Fists. We're down to, like, trying to choke the other person out. Like, we're down to being, like, so close and so vulnerable to the other person.
Remember, they had visions of each other.
They did.
They had visions of each other. I don't know.
They were close, though. They were close to each other.
They had visions of each other until they met.
I don't know if that's the case. Because if they were both each other's first death, they wouldn't have had that.
Well, they never technically said that. I prefer to think it, too. But you know what?
That just makes more sense, because otherwise they would have both realized that they were immortal before meeting each other.
I got it. The proximity thing doesn't matter for the first death. The first death is just a single siren call to everyone, regardless of distance. Okay. So in that moment, they both died, but they both felt each other. They both felt each other's deaths.
And that was not enough to stop them.
But it was enough to make them realize what they had.
Oh, jeez.
They realized in that moment what they had together. They realized that they were not truly alone, but their faith and their loyalty to their nations kept them fighting until there was no army left to fight for. It was just them, and when it was just them and the remains of their blood on the battlefield, what was left to fight for? Each other.
I think what was left to fight for was trying to find any decent clothes, get out of the fucking battlefield before the carrion eaters come.
I'm betting most of the dead soldiers, they probably had, there was at least someone who had just got like a spear in the face and their arm was okay. So they just picked up that.
I don't think they would have. I think at that point, they probably would have sat down and whatever shared language they had would have had to have been enough to have a conversation long enough to know that, hey, we need to not look like soldiers from these armies right now. And we need to go someplace and eat because we are both so fucking hungry. Because they have to eat. I can imagine that just the energy of fighting would exhaust the fuck out of them.
I don't think
Not to mention the mental strain.
The thing is, I think that they need to sleep, but I don't think they need to eat. I think they get thirsty and hungry, but I don't think they need to eat. Like, they can't starve to death either.
I mean, they can starve to death. They could die that way.
But then what happens? I
don't know.
The thing is, it's not just fatal injuries that they heal immediately.
True. At what point does the human body feeding on itself count as injury? Ketosis? Probably. I would say ketosis.
I would actually say that it probably starts at anaerobic respiration.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Like, I think that's also why they have such great stamina. Because they cannot
get to the point where what the myosin heads don't actually get ripped off, and whatever physical shape they were in when they died is what they will continuously stay no matter how much they train.
And that doesn't counteract the fact that they can still suffocate and drown, because oxygen is still required for basic neurological function. But for muscular function, they heal so quickly
that, like, something on that microscopic of a level would not even register.
Yeah, they are they could probably just marathon it.
Okay, so sleeping then would be for the mental faculties.
Yeah, sleeping is on a spiritual level, like,
just
for
just turning it off for a resting, second. True resting.
It's not actually a biological need.
I like that. I also like the gay fanfic that we just came up with.
I think that's completely accurate.
I think it's fucking fantastic. I think they went and got a bunch of... Stole some clothes off a clothesline from someplace nearby that didn't get completely fucked up, and then they just went to the nearest town and were like, okay,
let's party.
What the fuck is going on?
Let's like, party, let's get a room together.
Like, let's get a room together and then let's just chat. I don't know if they spoke the same language.
I like my half theory of one of them actually being in the Crusades much longer than the other one, because that actually gives them an excuse to know the other guy's language.
True. Well, depending on how close they were in the world, because some of the Crusades went way the fuck out there, as far as I know. I don't really know that much about the Crusades. I know that
it was like, whatever.
What, one of the English kings or some shit.
Listen, we're an average viewer. We know about as much as the average viewer about the Crusades. So as far as I'm concerned, we're making an average theory based on what the average writer could have thought of us to think.
So Niccolo di Genova.
Clearly Italian.
Okay, so from the Italy region.
Yeah.
And then Yusuf al...
Caisani. Now, they were both speaking Italian with each other, by the way. And at no point did either of them speak Arabic.
True.
I think Italian is their shared language.
Okay.
So I would be willing to bet that Joe is actually the older one.
Interesting.
Doesn't even have to be by very long. Could just be like by 50 years. That's like one extra crusade that he got.
Picked up Italian. Okay. I honestly, it would be even more interesting if they did not have a shared language. If it was just a matter of like literally how bare bones down in humanity do we need to get before these two will stop trying to kill each other?
They clearly had common ideas already, and that was enough. And thinking this, they could have figured it out.
I do think they did figure their shit out, but I think it would make for a much more interesting thing to see if they can't, like, actually talk with each other.
Fully agreed.
I mean, they can still obviously say things to each other and eventually figure out, you know, common phrases, shared syntax, like, that kind of stuff. Like, that's easy enough to figure out if you spend a long enough time with somebody, you will figure out how to talk to them. But, like,
So, anyway, back to my overall thesis... I said bits and pieces of it here, but I think that the main theme was kind of the passing of the torch from Andy to Nile as Amazon Queen of these immortals and as the guiding hand or the guided hand of fate. And
the
ultimate answer to the question, why is Andy alive, is answered in two ways. One, well, not for much longer.
That's not a why.
That's not a why, but...
It's not a why.
It's not a why, but sort of an attenuating answer. And the real answer is because she still had work to do. And as soon as her work was done, as soon as she could actually put down her weapon and do something else with her life, like teach Nile how to pick up that same weapon... Niall's going to learn how to use that goddamn axe.
Oh, absolutely. The moment in the small scene in the destroyed car at the very end where she reaches for and picks up the axe that was embedded into the guy by Andy, but she was the one who picked it up.
Quinn coming back from drowning at the very end and presenting herself to Booker, not even to Andy directly, but to Booker.
Yeah.
Probably because he's more exposed or whatever. I don't know. Who cares?
I would assume so.
Yeah, probably. But who cares? Doesn't really matter why. She is going to be the anti-Amazon. She is going to... Her purpose, assuming that she is an antagonist in a future sequel...
I mean, they're definitely framing it that.
She is going to try to be the downfall of fate. She is going to try to tear down what the fates intend and what Nile intends, and Andy is going to give her life to stop that.
Perhaps.
Because
honestly, I think it works out.
Because at that point, Andy is going to be the aging mentor. They could show her as an old woman.
Yeah, they could.
And the rest of them is just the same age, and it would still work.
The fact that she went to Booker makes sense because both of them, at some point or another, had given up, had just wanted to
die. It might be the thing that brings them together
and makes them the force of, like, the force of entropy, basically.
Yeah, and they, assuming that they did get together 6 months after, this will be before Andy reaches the end of her natural lifespan.
Oh, yeah.
So this is the excuse for them to all see each other again.
That's within, we don't need to do any Hollywood makeup shit.
Yes, they just need to age her up a little bit.
They just need to not put makeup. They're cowards, they won't do it.
Yeah, they won't do that.
This is well within the range of like, we can just shoot this again, whatever.
But yeah.
Who gives a fuck?
But yeah, Nile, agent of fate, and Andy misinterpreted her own reason for losing her immortality. It's not because she lost faith. It's because she was no longer required for fate's whims.
You hear that, showrunners? Take notes. You did it wrong. Either that or... They wrote it that way intentionally because within the context of a character having her own motivations, as far as we can assume a character would, it does make sense that she would come to that conclusion because she's not thinking about the bigger picture, which means that she wouldn't really contextualize herself as a mentor, as
Yeah, she's not thinking of herself as being part of a story. She's just a warrior. A warrior does not reason why a warrior's job is to do or die. She doesn't die, so she does.
Exactly.
Yeah, and exactly. Quinn is going to come back with one very simple premise in mind. She is going to actually completely understand all of this fate. So she is going to completely see that she wasn't thrown in there because humanity was cruel. Mm-hmm. She was thrown in there because she had a purpose to serve. She's going to misunderstand that purpose. She's going to distort it and warp it beyond recognition. But she understands that her time spent drowning for eternity, for 500 plus years, it was not wasted. It was doing something to her, and that she had a higher calling. And she's going to warp that into doing that to fate down.
I mean, that's so fucked on so many levels.
And in doing so, by tearing fate down, she is ultimately going to somehow strengthen Niall's power.
Listen, you could have just said there can be only one Queen Bee, and that would have been fine, but instead you went for a extremely fucked interpretation of purposeful fate, which, like, for the record, I like it. It's very interesting, but also, oh my god.
Yeah, fate doesn't give a crap about anyone.
Suffering.
Fate doesn't care
about suffering, except it does care about suffering in larger scale.
Fate cares.
We will kill a bunch of mice.
Fate cares about making sure that the right players and the right pieces are on the board at the right time. Mm-hmm. Doing the right thing. And Quinn coming back and trying to cause some mayhem and probably killing Andy is going to be a huge call to action for Niall.
Well, yeah.
And the others, by extension.
Okay, this is all sequel talk.
Yes.
Also, by the way.
But they could have brought Quinn back in the next movie and not mention her at all in this movie at all, and we wouldn't be talking about it. Quite frankly, I wouldn't care about the sequel. Besides, I'd still want to watch it, but I wouldn't be theorizing about it.
I had kind of given up on the sequel. Aside from that tiny, tiny scene at the very end, I think that was a good...
That was a complete story.
Complete story that it did not wrap everything up. It did not give us all of the answers, but that's okay.
It told us everything we needed. It told us everything we needed. We could infer what was going to happen, and they put that scene there because they did have an idea for a sequel in mind. Because they did not think that Niall's story
was... I guess.
And Andy, probably.
But. I don't care what they thought was happening. I care what is on.
And congratulations, you just mirrored my whole thesis.
Yeah.
They didn't know exactly what they were doing, but they had the right idea.
Are you thinking that I said that unintentionally?
Just now.
Are you thinking that I said that unintentionally?
No.
I repeat.
No.
Okay, thank you. It's like your smug little, oh, congratulations, you fell into my trap. I'm like,
you fell into my trap card.
You activated my trap card. Also, you can't say that.
What? Yeah, I can. Fucking watch me, bro.
Call me a fucking, can't believe you.
I didn't call you shit. Listen.
Happy Pride Month.
Happy Pride.
I was going to talk about the cinematography.
Fantastic music.
Oh my god. Yes.
Yes.
The music, all of it was, I guess, was modern music. Like, it was all, it was all pop. It was all rap. I think there was some hip hop in there.
There's some orchestral bits as well.
There's some orchestral bits. Yeah, there's the somber music was very background music of movie.
Yeah.
TM. Especially because for a lot of the locations that we went to, the old abandoned church house, the cave,
they used historic scenes for everything except the lair of the villain. The lair of the villain was very modern, high tech,
modern glass architecture, brutalism, giant name on the side of it, proclaiming like, I am here, I am super important, fuck you. Mm-hmm. He obviously was antithetical to everything that they like believed they stood for, that they narratively stood for,
and like, it was really, really well highlighted. Okay, I'll talk a little about cinematography. It's really well highlighted when he picked up the axe of his enemy, sort of traditionalist, faithful Amazon hand of fate, and he picked it up like it meant anything. No, it was a powerless weapon in his grasp. The way he was holding it was only one thing.
He was fascinated by it.
Yeah, because it was a thing that he could never achieve. And the weapon was useless to him.
Oh, yeah, no, like, when he was standing at the top of the stairs while all the other guys were waiting for the breach to happen at his penthouse, he was dwarfed by it.
Mm-hmm.
He's such a, like, a small person, sort of vaguely holding it.
Okay. In any case...
The cinematography.
Yes, your cinematography. Yeah. Please, go on.
Overall, aside from a couple of establishing shots that we get of, like, this is new location, we spent a lot of time really close up with people. Really zoomed in on some faces. And even the fight scenes, extremely well choreographed. Holy shit. Even though, quote unquote, it's an action shooty movie with a bunch of physical fighting elements to it, I felt entertained in every fight. I think there were only maybe a couple of times where I was just like, ah. Like, most of it was, oh, that was an interesting thing that they did there. Oh, that was another interesting thing. Ooh, wow, look at that fucking move. Like, it was all very well framed in that act was going on.
One important thing that I did notice about the choreography, Andy's fighting style. The others doesn't really matter as much. But Andy's fighting style. Mm-hmm. She was not hyperkinetic. Okay, sorry. Okay, I shouldn't use that phrase. She was not at superhuman level.
No.
She didn't have any extra fine motor control or like that. And she didn't even have, like, particularly stupendous strength. All of her power was just in martial poise, planning, and her absolute faith in herself that she was going to win the fight.
Yeah.
She assumed that her blows would land, and all of them, even from the very first, like, raid, they never wasted a shot.
Yeah.
There were no extra bullets on anyone. When they fired, it's because they knew that they would hit. They had a clear shot.
That they would hit.
And that's not because of some superhuman ability to know that it was a win, but because just total experience and training meant that they knew exactly when to fire and when, don't waste a bullet.
Yeah, this is just a matter of, like, you know what it is that you need out of any given situation, out of any given movement, and that is what you do.
Yeah. This is centuries of experience of just like, yeah, been there, done that. This is all rote movement. And however artistic and graceful it looks, it's not actually, especially in those slow instances, which is fantastic.
I fucking love the fight choreography.
It was good.
I love the fight choreography, specifically when they move to physical weapons as well. But the interplay that they had with, you know, picking up guns, using them until they ran out of shots or until they weren't relevant for the situation that they were in, and using them as bludgeoning weapons and then tossing them. All of that was fucking amazing. Also, did you notice how they got through the armor? It started in the very first fight scene after they got back up in the basement.
Slit straight through it. What armor are you talking about?
How they used guns to get through the armor. So bulletproof vests are really only good for, like, the first time that they're used.
Yeah, they just shot twice.
They shot, like, 3-4 times, but point blank. They specifically went up, held the gun against, like, solar plexus point on the person, fired once, it jammed it further in there, and then fired a couple more times. They did that several times, too, and I was just like, oh, okay.
They know how it works.
Okay, this is what we're doing. All right, fuck yeah. Using the sword break properties of it. So, like, if you have a weapon that has, like, teeth, essentially, or, like, gaps in it, you can use that to catch, and if the weapon is, you know, correctly, like, thick enough or made well enough, you can use it to break blade. And she did that once with somebody's arm. She caught it in the top teeth of it and then snapped it sideways. I'm just like, oh my god, yes.
Delicious.
Fuck. Oh, amazing.
Fully agree.
I love that kind of shit.
Fully agree.
Cinematography, very good.
I will wrap up with one stupid nitpick I had about this movie.
Yeah, do it. Do it.
When Andy first shot Niall, she was trying to et cetera, and bolt to the brain.
I think I know the beat.
Why is it always so slow at first? It's like, hold on. No, it's not. It's not slow in any objective sense. Two, it was arguably faster than when, not arguably, it is incalculably faster than when everyone else was, like, resurrecting in the basement. They took, like, 20, 25 seconds to, like, fully get up and start growing. It's like, why the fuck everyone didn't turn around and just shoot them all over again
in that time? I think that was done for a dramatic effect.
Yes.
I feel like,
and you know what,
we held on it for a long while.
Yes. And you know what, I think that was a mistake.
Yeah.
I think that was a mistake precisely because it would have made way more sense from a practical perspective just to have them resurrect quickly and start taking everyone down, because they knew that they would, and two, it's not a surprise that they were going to resurrect. We knew it ahead of time. They implied in so many ways, again, from the very first fucking, they were not dead. The mechanics of how they weren't dead, fine, sure. Yay, they come back to life and heal. They can show a few seconds of shots of them healing. That's 5 seconds at the absolute dramatic max. Any longer than that, okay. And they're being slow to get up, and they should have gotten shot again. They should have gotten shot again. They should have been handcuffed. Everything.
And two things to that point. First off, I agree with you. The timing of it, for whatever dramatic purposes it was done, it took way too long at the start. It felt, even if it wasn't scene-wise, on-screen time long, it felt longer, and they did that on purpose to make it feel longer.
Yeah.
And so yeah, that kind of counteracts it. Point one, they didn't shoot them because they all ran out of bullets. They all used all of their bullets. Well, that's what all the casings falling on the ground were supposed
to show. Well, they needed a reload.
Yeah.
They didn't get a chance to reload because they didn't think to reload because, oh, they
didn't
dead.
Have anything available.
They're dead whatever. And they didn't think about it.
But the casings that fell that I saw on some of the guns seemed to be the belt load type, where instead of being a assault cartridge, it's a fed belt that flows up into the gun and they get used one by one, like high caliber bullets. Those are harder to start a new belt into, I don't
reject the premise that it was going to be slow to reload. I just think it's a little that silly. It would have been incredibly stupid of them to not immediately be reloading and handcuffing them anyway, especially if they were there for the premise of ambushing a group of suspected immortals.
I don't think they were told. The way that they said, oh fuck, oh shit, like they legitimately freaked out, I think either they weren't told, which, honestly, possible. They probably weren't fucking told, because why would they need to be told the specifics of why they were doing this? They just need to know, hey, we're going to lure these people into here. We need you to kill them.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
That's all that needed to be said. Or they were told that this was the suspicion, and they just did not fucking believe it. Because they're like, okay, guys, yeah, sure, fuck you.
And they didn't take their appropriate precaution, whatever.
Yeah, because, like, why the fuck would you? You just literally shot them full of bullet holes. They're dead.
Yeah. And I will accept perfectly fine for the purpose of dramatic effect, yada, yada, yada.
I don't think you're accepting them. That's fine. Don't accept
I
it.
I accept the reason.
Don't accept mediocrity in presentation.
I acknowledge mediocrity. I didn't accept it. Okay, there's my correction.
Okay.
I acknowledge the intent behind the long 30-second scene of Resurrection.
It just sucks that they went back on it later, and it didn't...
It didn't.
I don't know.
The fact of it being super slow at the beginning, it didn't add anything meaningful to Niles' combats.
At the point of them storming the lab, she
was
started coming up pretty fucking quickly. It was a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
For one, she was playing dead when they shot her in the initial hallway. Like, right before she started going through everybody.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Like, obviously. And, like, from then on, she was, you know, putting herself in front of Andy to take bullets and then continued on. Because, one, I don't think she died from all of those hits. She was just healing.
Yeah.
But also, like, come
on. Yeah, only headshots can actually take them down one go. Yeah. I think even heart shots, like, it might cripple them for, like, a split second, but it's not going to be enough to actually take them down.
I think Booker was taken out by the grenade to the gut. I think he was dead for a bit. And then
Booker
got to a point where his brain was working, and that's when he came back up. Which, like, okay, but also,
And he was in such terrible agony with his guts on full.
I think at that point, you can make a case that even if he is, like, alive again, his body would be in a kind of shock, because that is a kind of pain.
He could also argue that his nerves hadn't fully reconnected yet.
True.
I think that's more like...
I wonder if they connect at the same time.
The alcohol dull.
Which does beg the question, how quickly does that shit get filtered out, huh? Because it seemed like the knockout drugs also worked on that. So I don't think I think healing is a damage only.
Yeah.
It is not an effect. Because, like... alcohol, certain, like, surgery, puts you under drugs, have a dampening effect on certain things. It blocks certain hormonal things from happening, too.
Yeah.
And, like,
it's an interesting question of, like, how cyanide would affect them. Because Something that, like, completely inhibits metabolic processes?
If we have decided that they cannot do anaerobic, cannot have anaerobic damage done to them, or as soon as it's done, it stops.
Yeah, but that's damage.
Yeah.
What about a poison? Because, very importantly, the question, just like they make new blood and whatnot, do they destroy the poison? Do they unmake the poison? Because if they don't... I think
it would flush it out. Because if it is creating new blood, the other stuff is spilled out. It's gone.
Sure. And if it is being flushed out, then great, cool. And if the bolts are being flushed out, fine, we have precedent for it. Fine.
Yeah.
And they've probably tried that before and it didn't work. Booker definitely did.
Yeah, I think so.
But yeah. Precisely because Booker was able to get drunk, I think there's a kind of semantic acceptance by the Fates that, okay, what is damage versus what is not damage?
Booker never... Oh, no.
Booker was absolutely drunk.
He never seemed drunk. Like, that last scene was kind of the only one where he was, like, actually, like, tipsy.
He was actively drinking. I think it's a very short-term effect.
But, yeah, that's what I'm thinking, is that, like, it takes effect, and then as soon as it would go into damage territory, it starts getting undone. His liver is probably extremely good at filtering it out pretty fucking fast.
Yeah.
Because the liver is not going to take damage from doing it, so it can work at max capacity.
Exactly.
Ah, so shit.
The fates don't care about your fucking loopholes.
Because he also, as soon as he walked, he was stumbling, as soon as he walked through the door... He noticed somebody was there, gun up at the ready.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he's not.
He pushed the door open and he didn't see his face, but he's like, he knew something was up.
His stance solidified. His arms were up. He was pointing his firearm at the person in his house. That was instant.
Point is, fascinating movie, fascinating premise. Fascinating implications, but also thematically, they absolutely had a single thread and they nailed
it. Yeah.
In every way except the character's own understanding of themselves.
Which, like,
But with all the pieces that we got enough.
There was one scene that I particularly did not like. It's the scene when Niall has her crisis moment where she wants to leave. She doesn't want to storm the compound. Mostly because it was like, it's like, okay, how many refusals of the call are we going to have? That happened so far into the movie. So far after all of that other shit had happened.
I think that's only halfway
through. Are you sure? Because it felt like most of the group.
It was halfway through. The guys got kidnapped halfway through. It wasn't that far in.
The sense of time.
It's a long movie. This movie definitely has, like, one short act and then, like, one.
The first third and then the last two thirds.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 I know how you think that. Because it's in the last two thirds.
Yeah,
because
all the stuff that happens in the last two thirds is kind of just one continuous, like, this is the mission now, is rescuing the guys.
Yeah, that's just the way it is.
God. Okay.
I honestly would have thought it was very silly if she just accepted her new fate.
Well, yeah. From a story standpoint, she needed to not do the thing, because if she just went along with it and was convinced, it would not have been as meaningful as a character.
She only went back because she knew that Andy was in danger. That is why she went back.
Yeah.
She didn't ask how Booker was. She didn't even make a big deal about... She didn't just like, Booker's the traitor. And everyone was like, yeah, we know. No.
No, she's just like, oh, all of you are tied up
here. She went in to save Andy.
Yeah.
That was her purpose. Mm-hmm. And saving Booker.
If that happened to be the thing. I think she definitely went in there to save Andy because she knew that Andy was being led into a trap and not able to save the other two.
Yeah.
So, like, do the one thing, save Andy, that will lead to a cascade of saving the others.
Yeah. And I don't think it would have been meaningful for her to save them without having the choice to do something else.
True.
So she didn't need to try to leave.
Oh. Well, yeah, I just don't like the, like, reasoning, the, like, little sob thing that she gave about, like...
Well, she's also a child, so...
Yeah, I just... it's bootlicky, and I hate it.
You're allowed to hate the armed force.
Yeah, and I do. But yes, you are correct. It needed to happen that way. Also because, like, oh my god, can you imagine how much of a painful kind of scene that would have been to get out of if they had all three gone in? Because Booker was planning on having them both with him. So he would have led them both into the room, shot both of them, and then everyone else would have come and handcuffed them, brought them into the same place that Nikki and Joe were. Yeah. And then riding yourself out of that is a lot more difficult than having the lone gunman who was not anticipated in any way, shape, or form coming in to save the day.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that Booker never told about Niall, because I think fundamentally he didn't want them to be captured. He just,
yeah.
If he could have been enough of a sample on his own, he would just allowed himself to be captured and just got into hiding.
He would have done that, but that was not what
they needed. Mr.
Pharmacy Guy.
Why do they need all four? Because Pharmacy Guy is a fucking moron.
Because he's greedy. Because he can't just take one person doing the thing. Because they need cross samples or whatever the fuck. Like, I don't
know. You know what comparison I'm gonna?
What's that?
Their immortality. Mm-hmm. You made a JoJo reference. Is there trouble?
I made a jelly ref?
JoJo.
Oh.
You kept mentioning JoJo stands and whatnot. No,
like, I mentioned it once.
Yeah, whatever.
I brought it up fucking once.
Yeah, whatever.
You listen, get off my ass about listen, this.
This is their trouble. This is their trouble. They don't understand why they have it. Mm-hmm. They didn't inherit it, sure. It
was activated.
But it was activated.
Yeah.
And it fit their personality. Troubles always find people.
You think this fits within the Stephen King extended universe?
No.
Okay, fine.
I'm saying that thematically it fits, and the other thematic of them needing a lot of different samples from a lot of different trouble board to understand what was going on. Fine.
Yeah.
That's my very silly comparison.
It's not a boon.
It's a curse.
Yeah.
But it is a curse that fits them. Mm-hmm. It is a curse that they have to live with and make the most of.
Yeah.
Which even some of them did. Avoiding it.
Yeah, some of them did do pretty well. Some of them didn't.
And some of them got fucked.
Yeah, as they do. But
it's a movie.
It is a movie. All right, final thoughts. Final thoughts on this movie, now that we have talked about it.
Good movie.
Good movie.
Good movie. I said all I needed.
Yeah, good movie. A lot of interesting stuff.
Fuck Netflix.
Very, very fun. Yes, fuck Netflix.
I like to be particular about my hate.
I see. So the French get it. The French get the scorn.
It's not France as a concept. France, it's a country. It exists. I acknowledge this. Mm-hmm. But the French. For legal reasons, this is a joke.
For legal reasons. Hey, listen, we're not in the UK. The libel laws there are fucking insane, apparently. I don't know if we can do...
Free speech zones?
I mean, we are in a... we're in a free speech zone.
We are in a free speech zone. That Europeans can only dream.
I don't know, I think.
They don't have that's each not a
individual
thing.
Individual country that might have its own thing. Protected speech.
It's not a thing there.
It's not a thing.
It's there. Not a thing there.
Okay, free this speech. Is something. This is something we need to go into.
This is free speech.
At another time.
This yes, free speech. It's a very American thing. We're the crazy ones.
We are the crazy ones. This is true. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good movie.
Good very movie. Interesting. You should watch it.
I should watch it.
Yes,
okay.
You. Yes, you know who you are.
Exactly.
Go watch it.
Right. So thank you very much for coming on. This is our continuing podcast.
Yeah, this is definitely not the movie review, as you were saying.
Boys have thoughts
on opinions.
Movies. Boys have opinions.
Yes. Thank you for having
me. Yeah. Is there anything you want the people to know? How to look you up? What projects you've got going on?
What projects I got going
on? You have a Twitter? You have a website?
I do, in fact. Have a Twitter at Parshaw, I guess. I don't use it. I don't think I have any tweets on it.
Then why would you plug it?
I don't know. I'm not trying to plug. You just asked me if I have
one. Okay, well, I'll beep out that section. Then nobody gets to go to your fucking Twitter.
Fine, I accept
you're this. Not even going to use it.
I'm working on a novel, which happens to dive into the immortality side of things. Similar question. And that's actually why this subject was near and dear to my heart.
Going into it, unbeknownst to you.
Yeah, that's fine. But no, I don't have anything that I particularly want. Great. Go ahead. Go bug K on my behalf.
All right. This has been very fun. This has probably been extremely long.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm just going to end it there.
Yep.
Bye.